Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What happens to military service members who are sexually assaulted? And do victims who report the abuse face greater consequences than their alleged attackers? A new report released by the Pentagon last week estimated that 26,000 people in the military suffered sexual assault in fiscal year 2012, up more than a third since 2010. And a little over a week ago, the man who led the Air Force's Sexual Assault Prevention and Response Unit was himself arrested and charged with sexual battery after allegedly groping a woman in a parking lot. So why is sexual violence such a rampant problem in the military, and why have efforts to curb it failed so miserably? Director Kirby Dick explores these questions and introduces us to a number of victims, both male and female, in his new documentary, The Invisible War. The film debuts tonight as part of the PBS series Independent Lens. You can see it on KERA Channel 13 television in North Texas at 10 o'clock. Kirby, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
So, poignantly, this film begins with a celebration of the promise that military service held for women when it was finally opened up, just as it had for men for centuries before that. And it seems most of the subjects that you interviewed loved their jobs, took pride in them, and that made that loss of trust all the more painful.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the things we found. My producer, Amy Ziering, and I, spoke with, well over 100 men and women. And you know, everyone was very patriotic, really was looking forward to a career in the military. Some of them had family members, one in particular going all the way back to the Revolutionary War. So they were looking forward to serving their country, to a career in the military. And so when they were assaulted, obviously it was extremely traumatic, but many of them had so much faith in the military that they came forward and reported that, even though many of the men and women around them were advising them not to. And what happened to them was they were investigated, they experienced very serious reprisals, and almost all of them were forced out of the military.
I was taken aback to learn that more than 20% of female military veterans are believed to have suffered sexual assaults while serving. So there's like 500,000 women walking around, an estimate, right now who've been sexually assaulted in the military.
Yeah, I would say up to 500,000 women. And you know, this is something that's been going on for decades, generations even. The report that just came out was that 26,000 men and women had been sexually assaulted in fiscal year 2012. Now, if you multiply that out over 50 years or more, you're approaching a million men and women being sexually assaulted.
Hmm. Kirby, what do we know about the alleged perpetrators and their records of sexual assault before they enlist in the military?
Well, the military has done some studies on this. They did anonymized studies where they asked people, you know, confidentially to state, this is on Navy recruits who just recently entered the military, whether they had either attempted rape or completed rape before they came into the military. And it turned out that 15% of men in that study had attempted or completed rape, which was about double what an equivalent civilian population would be. Now, I just want to qualify and clarify that the military was not aware when these men came in that they had, in most cases, I would say, in nearly all cases, that they had assaulted people. But It is very significant, and equally significant is that the military also attracts men and women who've been sexually assaulted or abused, and they come to the military looking for a second home, a safe home. But we know that people who have been assaulted are more likely to be assaulted again, and we know that people who have assaulted people are more likely to assault again. So the military has a perfect storm situation here, that up until now it has not done the reforms it needs to do to get control of this, and that's why the numbers are so high.
So what's the procedure by which military service members are expected to report sexual assaults and then have those assaults investigated?
Well, there's a number of ways they can report, but what's critical here is the decisions to investigate and prosecute are made within the chain of command by senior officers in the chain of command. And so they're set up, there's a conflict of interest situation where the commander may know the perpetrator or the victim, or they may know the commander of the perpetrator or the victim. So it's not impartial justice. That's the problem. And so not only are many cases not investigated because there is that that conflict of interest, but even more important, the other thing that this study that came out revealed is that less than 10% of men and women actually report their sexual assault. And the reason they don't is because they know that there is this institutional bias. They know they won't get impartial justice. And in fact, when we were speaking with the hundreds of people we spoke with, as I said, everyone was advised by their peers not to report because it's just common knowledge that it can really be the end of your career if you report. So as a result, people aren't reporting, and what happens is that the perpetrator, and the other thing we know is that most of these perpetrators are serial predators. They assault again and again. So you have a serial predator going on to assault. Every time someone doesn't report, that serial predator goes on to assault again with impunity.
Let's listen here to a former member of the Coast Guard, Corey Choka, who was attacked despite multiple pleas to be assigned away from someone who had been harassing her.
I was the only female in my section. I had a supervisor. It got to the place where I'd get calls at 3 o'clock in the morning and he'd be drunk at a bar telling me to come get him. And I'm like, I can't, I'm in bed. And he would then threaten me. I'd walk in from training and he'd be sleeping in my bed. When we went to one of the higher ups, the chain of command, they were all like his drinking buddy. And they told me just because I didn't like somebody, they weren't going to switch me away from this guy. It was in the evening around taps, and he had unlocked the door and he'd come in and he had an erection and he tried to get me to touch him. I took my right hand and I pushed him in the chest and started to yell for the other guys to kind of hear me, to hey, hey, hey. He hit me across the left side of my face. I remember holding the closet thinking, what just happened? And my face hurts so bad. And when we went to the command about it, me and the petty officer who saw my face, they let it wait because they didn't want any kind of problems going on.
That was former Coast Guard veteran Corey Choka, who is featured in director Kirby Dick's documentary, The Invisible War, which will air tonight on KERA Channel 13 at 10 o'clock. That blow to the jaw that Corey Choka suffered has left her dealing with chronic pain. She's unable to this day to eat solid food, but she was denied VA medical care for that condition.
Yes, she was, and you know, she tried just multiple different. She made multiple attempts with various doctors, and just was unable to get the proper care. One thing I do want to say about the VA system. I mean, there's the healthcare system, and then there's the benefit system. And in general, the healthcare system is pretty good. I mean, there are situations like this where this happens. The benefits side of the VA, there's some real challenges. I mean, partly they're just overwhelmed with the number of men and women going all the way back to, you know, Vietnam War era and mm-hmm. before. But also, many, many veterans are having problems getting the benefits that they deserve. And we certainly found that out with victims of military sexual assault, that sometimes it took decades. And there's a segment in our film where she, over the course of several seasons, she has to call into the VA and she keeps getting, recorded message. It took her, sometimes takes people years even to get through to the person that can really help them. So it's a very broken system in some ways.
And, she referred in that soundbite that we heard to the fact that when she tried to report it, people said, we don't want problems going on. It turns out there's sort of a disincentive for commanders to take these investigations further because it makes it appear as if they're not in control of their units.
Exactly. And that's the problem with this being, decision to investigate and prosecute remaining in the chain of command, because it reflects on the entire chain of command all the way up to the senior officers. And so what we're advocating is that it be moved outside of the chain of command so that trained prosecutors can make the decision on how and if to move forward on these cases. And in fact, Senator Gillibrand is going to be introducing a bill this Thursday which does just that. And I think this is going to be very, very significant. It's really historic because this is the most single most important reform of the military justice system to address the problem of military sexual assault. This is the single most important reform in history. So I know that the U.S. military is pushing back on this. They say, you know, it's a lot of the same. I mean, they are taking the problem more seriously, but it's a lot of the same response. It's like, trust us, we're on top of this. We're going to take care of it. We assure you there will be zero tolerance. They've been saying this for 50 years, and you just have to look that the number is 26,000. That's a 35% increase over 2011. So, no, they failed really quite miserably in their mission to protect our men and women in uniform.
And there were multiple cases in the film where people who spoke up were themselves disciplined and their alleged attacker got off scot-free.
Yes. I mean, we spoke to three women who were single. They were raped by a married man, and the women were either charged or threatened to be charged with adultery, and which is a serious crime in the military. So this is very common. Oftentimes, serial predators who are very calculating. I mean, this is not just in most cases a stranger jumping out of the bushes. This is someone with a higher rank who picks someone who's vulnerable, who seems isolated. And befriends them, you know, gives them alcohol, oftentimes to the point of incapacitation. Sometimes these women and men are under 21, which is in the military, that's a very serious crime to be caught drinking under the age of 21. And so oftentimes investigators would say to these people when they came forward to report that they'd been assaulted, "Are you sure you want to assault? Because we may have to charge you with underage drinking." Now, that, I think, has recently changed, but there is still that threat there. And, that, again, that's another reason that it has to be moved outside the chain of command. So somebody completely independent from their chain of command is making their decision. And one other thing I'd like to say, too, is that, you know, a sexual assault is a very personal crime, and many men and women don't want to report it into their workplace. They want to keep it separate from their workplace. I mean, and so that's another reason people don't report. They just say, "I'd rather not my boss or my boss's boss be aware that this is what I'm doing, and this is why it should be moved out of the chain of command."
Talk about this. There is also the issue that there are people who report and essentially they are treated as if they've lied. And I don't want to imply that there has never been a case of people falsely reporting sexual assault, but it seems to me that the motivation to do that, it doesn't make much sense.
Well, no. I mean, the statistics on this is that the claims of false rape are the same as any other crime. There's been studies ranging from 2 to 8%. It's very, very low. And you're right. There rarely is a motivation because, you know, people don't want to talk. Usually, you know, people don't want to talk about being raped or sexually assaulted. Usually, it's something very private. Mm-hmm. We found, especially among men, that oftentimes it took people decades to come forward and talk about their sexual assault. So, yeah, in most cases, they don't want to report a sexual assault. So, but yes, I mean, I think the military is shifting on that. I know that the film had a very strong impact on the military, on the way it sees this issue. But I think the military is now sort of getting the message that the claims of false rape are very, very small. The number of claims is very small.
My guest is filmmaker Kirby Dick. He directed The Invisible War, which will air tonight as part of the PBS series Independent Lens. You can see it on KERA Channel 13 television in North Texas at 10 o'clock. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is filmmaker Kirby Dick. His documentary, The Invisible War, will air tonight on PBS stations around the country as part of the series Independent Lens. You can see it in North Texas on KERA Channel 13 tonight at 10 o'clock. You mentioned before the break, Kirby, we know that men as well as women are victimized, and you mentioned that there are men who sometimes wait decades before reporting. Let's listen now to Michael Matthews. This is a veteran who was raped at 19, talking about keeping his assault secret for years.
I had never told anybody in over 30 years. I decided to tell my wife. It was the scariest moment in my life. I was going to tell my wife she was going to leave me. And I would be lost without her. I mean, honest to God, I couldn't get up every morning without my wife, you know? And I told her.
I felt horrified, and I felt sad, and I felt angry, and, you know, along the course of the evening, you know, feelings just started to surface that were probably just simmering for a very, very long time.
And she put her arms around me, and we both sat there and sobbed. It was like this great weight had been lifted off of me.
That is a clip from director Kirby Dick's documentary, The Invisible War. Michael Matthews' attack, as well as the others that are listed and described in the film, are a reminder, Kirby, that sexual assault is almost inevitably about power and not about sex.
Exactly. In actual numbers, more men than women are sexually assaulted in the U.S. military. According to the Department of Defense estimates that came out last week, nearly 14,000 men were sexually assaulted as compared to 12,000 men in fiscal year 2012. So this is something that, you know, it's not a women's issue. And you can see it in many ways. It has absolutely nothing to do with whether women are serving in the military. It's something that, as you said, it's a crime of power and not of sex.
And I would hasten to add here that it is not attributed to the presence of, the acceptance of gays and lesbians in the military. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, in many cases, if not most cases, these assaults are actually being done by heterosexual men. So it absolutely doesn't have to do with that as either.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about training, because the military is aware that these things are going on. They have made efforts. There are films and posters. But it seems like the people you talk to sort of laughed at these efforts.
Well, certainly. There's one poster in particular that the military actually was quite proud of, which was a poster that said, you know, showed a picture of a woman in uniform, and then underneath it, it said, "Wait until she's sober," which was entirely sending the wrong message. You know, they have started to make some changes, some improvements on this, although I think something recently came out last week in one manual that was suggesting that women should not try to fight off their assailants, which I think is, you know, goes against all sort of unless their assailant has a weapon, of course, mm-hmm. Which I think you know, goes against all advice, certainly coming from civilian sexual assault advocates. So they are working on it. I mean, to their credit, they're using the Invisible War as part of their sexual assault training programs. Many of the branches are doing that, and that is in part because they just do not have the tools. The way they are trying to attack this problem is they're trying to change the culture within the military. They're trying to, you know, lower the misogyny, increase, you know, respect for certainly for women, but just for, you know, people's personal rights, really, and that's a good thing. But that is not really going to solve the problem. That will help address it, but it's not going to solve it, because the real problem here is that the military has an embedded serial predator problem. I mean, it has thousands of embedded serial predators that are assaulting again and again, and no amount of education is going to change what they do. The criminal justice system has to be changed so that the decision to prosecute these serial predators is taken outside of the chain of command. And another reason that's important is because investigating and prosecuting a sexual assault crime is among the most difficult. And so if you have a commander deciding whether that should be done, he or she is not trained to do that. You need somebody who's trained, who understands the mind of a serial predator. And in many cases, these serial predators are the highest performing soldiers. They're often type A, you know, very alpha, and their commanders have great respect for them and cannot imagine that they're actually serial predators. Hmm. But a trained prosecutor is able to see through that that guise and actually decide whether to prosecute them.
And of course, we need to keep in mind that eventually these individuals leave military service and are, you know, in the community living next door to you and me.
Exactly. So many of these serial predators get off with an honorable discharge, and then they just go on to assault again and again. And it makes the civilian community very vulnerable, because civilians rightly, you know, respect the military, and someone who has an honorable discharge, they, I think, inherently trust, which makes the civilian community even more vulnerable. And this is something, even today, I don't feel that the military actually has gone out of its way to make public who these serial predators are, even the few that they do put behind bars.
We should talk again about this idea of, you know, we respect and value the military, which we should, but that shouldn't cover up problems that exist. And one very sad case in the film is that of Hannah Sewell, who joined the Army to follow in her father's footsteps. He encouraged her all along the way, assuming that she would be, in his words, taken care of.
Once he was done, he rubbed his hand all over my entire body and told me, he said, "I own all of this." And I was just absolutely scared, didn't know what to do. I called my dad.
One of the first things she said is, "Dad, I blow like a virgin." And I said, "What happened?" He said, "I was raped." And I said, "Hannah, you're a virgin, because he took something from you that you didn't give." I said, "So don't ever think you're not."
So much pain there in that that clip from Kirby Dick's film, The Invisible War. Another element that really struck me, Kirby, was that many women say that they were attacked by their sort of colleagues, people who are of the same rank that they served with. It felt, until these attacks happened, like brothers to them. That, again, creates like a new emotional wrinkle when they're betrayed in these ways.
Yes. I mean, in most cases, they were assaulted by people that they knew, usually of a higher rank, but not always. And again, this is a strategy that these serial predators use. They oftentimes find someone who's maybe coming into a unit, who's new to a unit, who doesn't have a lot of experience, and they go out and, you know, extend a hand and befriend them and say, "Look, I'll show you the ropes, I'll help you." And so, naturally, the woman or man feels, you know, very grateful to this person and feels like they developed a real bond with them. So that allows the serial predator to get them in situations where they can assault. And it's like, this is something they're, you know, they're very strategical. One thing from that Navy recruit study, you know, on these serial predators, on the men that had, you know, had attempted or committed rape before, the only thing that they found was different from those predators and the rest of the Navy recruit population, there's only one difference, in that those predators were smarter. So the idea that this is a brute jumping out from, you know, behind the bushes, it's not that at all. These are very smart, often very high-achieving men that you do not expect would be a predator. Again, another reason why it has to be put in the hands of trained prosecutors to go after these men.
And in the prevention training that existed when you were making the film, and I understand your point that some of this is starting to change, but often the onus would be on women who might be attacked, who ought to have a companion walking across a base with them, rather than sort of changing the culture and making it clear that this would never be acceptable on the part of men. It was sort of up to women to defend themselves.
Right. Yes. No. There is, and there still is to some degree a victim blaming culture in the military. That it's their, you know, their responsibility to protect themselves, and if they get assaulted somehow, it's their fault. In fact, you know, General Welsh, the Chief of Staff of the Air Force, just last week made a comment that one of the problems was, women and the hookup culture. And Senator Gillibrand, responded, quite angrily to that statement, saying, this is not a date gone bad. These are serial predators who are, in many cases, and this is really important, using drugs and alcohol to completely incapacitate their victims. So oftentimes their victims are assaulted when they're, they're completely unconscious.
And this goes to even elite units. I was really surprised to read about the very elite Marine Guard that essentially provides security at the White House. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Right. It's the base of the Marine Barracks, Washington. It's, right in Washington, D.C. It's the most prestigious Marine base in the world. Many war heroes come back and are serving there. And among its responsibilities is to guard the president and certainly to, provide its troops at Camp David. And so it's very highly regarded and, with good reason. At the time of making the film, there was we encountered, many women who had been sexually assaulted who were, they were not, their assaults were not properly investigated at all. In fact, in all cases, investigations were initiated into them. And there was also a very severe drinking culture there as well, which was, which was really astonishing that oftentimes these are, high-ranking officers were getting drunk, oftentimes to the point of passing out in public. It allowed a cover for these serial predators to operate and go after the women who were on the base.
When a woman in the military or a man reports that they have been sexually assaulted, is there any requirement for there automatically to be, a rape kit performed and that sort of thing?
Yes. For the most part, if they go to a hospital and they say they've been sexually assaulted, I mean, obviously they have to consent to a rape kit being mm-hmm. done. But that is something that is generally offered to them. I mean, I think a few years ago, that was even a year or two ago, that was not always the case by any means. What we found, unfortunately, is in many of these investigations, these rape kits were quote-unquote lost. And in fact, Hannah, who you played a clip from, her situation was, she went to, she was trying to assist the investigation into her assailant, and she was told that one of the reasons the case was dismissed is they didn't have the rape kit. It turned out later on, and she continued to do research, that in fact they did have the rape kit. They made the claim the rape kit was lost, and it turned out later on that in fact they did have the rape kit, but by then, the case had been dismissed.
We have an email here from a listener, Cecilia, and I'll just read the subject line because the email is rather lengthy, but Cecilia says, it is so hypocritical that the U.S. makes demands on other countries about human rights when rape is an institutionalized, military, insidious problem. What do you think about that?
Well, I would agree with that comment that it's extremely important for the U.S. military to look at the problems within its own ranks and within its own culture and certainly with its own military justice system. I do want to say, however, that most men in the military are not rapists,
of
and
course.
Most men are horrified by this. We found the film premiered at Sundance in 2012, where it won the Audience Award, and it was the Sundance Film Festival is in Utah, and there were many men and women within the military who actually came and saw the film, and they came up to us afterwards, and they were really thankful to us that we'd made the film. They said, "We know it's a problem. We hope the film changes things." And there's no question that most men in the military are not rapists. Most commanders do not want this in their units. So. But the problem is that the Pentagon has not taken this seriously. It has really approached this issue for generations by trying to cover it up, by trying to not let it get to the public, and by still continuing to claim that it can solve this problem. It can't. It has had 75 years to solve this problem, and I don't want to be in a situation where 10 years from now there's another 250,000 men and women who've been assaulted and I have to come back and make a sequel to this. Not at all. I think now is the time for the military to step up and really make the reforms that need to be made.
What happened when you showed a cut of this film to then-Defense Secretary Leon Panetta?
Well, he saw the film. It made a great impact on him, and he held a press conference a couple of days later where he had announced some important changes to how these crimes are prosecuted. They're only first steps, because what he did is he elevated the decision to investigate and prosecute these crimes from the level of unit commander to the level of colonel or Navy captain. So that was an important first step, and we know he held that press conference because the film made such an impact on him.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the military, I think up until the film came out, there were many, many people in the military who really didn't take this problem seriously, partially because there wasn't a face to it. I mean, there are some very powerful men and women speaking in our film. These are, you know, patriotic young men and women that, you know, we want in our military, that certainly the Pentagon wants in the military. So I think that helped change and make them, you know, make them realize that it was a serious issue. But like large institutions that, you know, they're always their first response is say, we've got, you know, we can handle it, let us do it our way. That hasn't worked.
Is there something about, I mean, you don't hear about rapes to this extent on, say, college campuses where you also have young men and women living close together. Is there something about the culture of the military that contributes to this problem?
Well, I think one is that you have the issue of rank, mm-hmm. which is makes for, you know, if you have a serial predator of a higher rank, he has a kind of power over the people underneath him that... in world that wouldn't exist. For example, he could just really command somebody underneath him to come to his apartment at 11 p.m. at night. And in most cases, there's very little they can do. That's an order, they have to obey it. I think the other thing that's different about rape in the military is if you're raped in the military, you can't just leave. If you're in the civilian world and you're raped, you can leave your job if your perpetrator is still, you know, in that company. But here you can't. And you can't go back to your family, to your mother or father and or friends and get support. So if the military doesn't respond properly to a victim coming forward, it can be extremely damaging. And we know
Let me jump in. We have to take a quick break.
Sure.
My guest is director Kirby Dick. We're talking about his new documentary, The Invisible War. We'll be back to the conversation in about 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is director Kirby Dick. He has produced a film called The Invisible War, which will premiere tonight as part of the PBS series Independent Lens. You can see it in North Texas on KERA Channel 13 television tonight at 10 o'clock. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. And Kirby, before the break, you were saying that part of the problem within military culture, one, is there's a rank issue, and two, people who are victimized can't just quit and sort of move on to another place.
Right. And as a result, it can be very emotionally and psychologically devastating if you report and then people, you can imagine, they turn on you or they don't believe you. And in many cases, you're left in this the same unit with your assailant. Sometimes, you know, that your commander is your assailant, which is, and we know that not only the military, but especially in military situations, if they don't respond properly and protect the victim can then develop very extreme PTSD symptoms. And in fact, there are studies that done that women have as high a rate or even a higher rate of PTSD, women who've been sexually assaulted, as compared to men coming back from combat. So it's a very serious issue. And up until very, very recently, the military has really failed on that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak now with Jasmine in Fort Worth. Hi, Jasmine.
Hi. I wanted to say thank you, first of all, for, you know, I wasn't aware of these efforts to take the sexual assault issues outside of the chain of command, and I think it's wonderful. You already commented about the training, sexual assault prevention training, and I came out of the Army in 2009, and I went to Iraq and everything, and with all the training, when it came to sexual assault, it was a joke to everybody. It was a joke. The person giving the briefing was joking. Everybody was laughing, They came up with these scenarios that were just ridiculous, and out there. And, it really made victims feel like, wow, this is my fault. It's a horrible experience to feel guilty about it. And then after all that training, when it does happen to you, it happened to me, and I didn't come forward because of that reason, because I felt I would be ridiculed. And then, on top of that, we have all of these people who, they've had experiences, and we talk about it, between, the girls, like, oh my goodness, stay away from that sergeant because, this and this happened to me and nothing happened to them, It was a horrible, horrible thing. And when you're, I was in Iraq, I did a 15-month tour, and when you're more worried about being raped than being killed, it's kind of a sad situation. And, I always thought it was just so unfortunate that they didn't, focus on telling people, just don't rape, don't do this, instead of telling people how not to get raped, like, don't drink, don't, you talked about, going to the, somewhere with the battle buddy, in Iraq. Every time we went to the latrines, it was, make sure you take a battle buddy because you just never know. Every time you went, I was stationed in Germany for 3 years, and every time you went somewhere, it was like, make sure you're going to the dining facility with a battle buddy, and it's like, if you don't take these precautions and something happens to you, you feel like it's your fault.
Thank you so much, Jasmine. I'm so sorry to hear that happened to you. And Kirby, unfortunately, I know that this is Jasmine's story is not so different from that of the 100 people that you interviewed for the film.
Yeah, I mean, it's startlingly similar. We heard that same story over and over. And then, of course, we've had hundreds of people, contact us afterwards. The one thing I would, and she's very eloquent, and the one thing I would say to Jasmine is that, right now Congress is considering... is discussing this issue of taking the decision to prosecute outside the chain of command. So if you were able to get in contact, well, you are, if you could get in contact with your senators and your representative and to talk to them, I think, that would, obviously they want to hear from their constituents, particularly constituents who have been in the military, and especially constituents who have been in the military who have been assaulted. You have a very powerful voice, and you're very articulate on this matter, and I would, encourage you and any other listener who's been assaulted to reach out to their senators and their representative and let them know that you want these kind of changes to be made, in particular the support of Senator Gillibrand's bill to take it out of the chain of command.
It did seem there was sort of refreshing consensus on the part of members of Congress that this issue really needs to be addressed.
Yes, there has been, again, I think a lot of this actually has to do with the fact that the film has come out, and I know so many members of Congress have seen the film. In fact, in the hearing that Senator Gillibrand had, the Senate hearing in March, nearly every senator and certainly everybody who was testifying from the Pentagon, these three-star officers, all had seen the film. So it has become the reference point for the issue in Congress, in the administration, and in the military. And we're very pleased about that because now people are aware of the issue. But that's only the first step. As you can see, it's 26,000 men and women sexually assaulted in fiscal year 2012. They have a very serious problem.
I hate to even have to ask this question, Kirby, but these numbers are so vast, thousands upon thousands of victims, clearly thousands of perpetrators. You mentioned that many of them or some of them are sort of well-respected as soldiers, as Marines, as seamen. Is there any concern on the part of the military that they will lose soldiers that are otherwise good soldiers and therefore they hesitate to prosecute? Is that possibly a factor?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and this is a situation that happens often, where particularly when a unit is going into battle, if a commander, is even if a senior officer has to consider the units below them, whether they're going into a theater of war like Afghanistan or Iraq, mm-hmm. they have to consider, they have to make that sort of judgment call, and that's not impartial justice. That's something a prosecutor should be doing. In fact, I think many these are very difficult crimes to adjudicate, and I think many of these senior officers would feel much better not having to make this decision. I mean, we don't ask a senior officer who doesn't have training to fly a helicopter to go out and fly a helicopter. We shouldn't ask them to make a decision on how to investigate and prosecute a sexual assault crime without the proper training. Let the JAGs, the attorneys within the military, make that decision.
Why did the system get set up this way in the first place?
Well, it's been set up this way. I mean, it's been set up this way for obviously for centuries. I mean, a couple, 200 years ago, it made sense. I mean, you're out in a theater of war. It takes communication isn't instantaneous like it is today.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes, they didn't even bring JAGs out into the field. So they when there was a claim of sexual assault, the commander had to make a decision in that position because there was no way it could be done elsewhere otherwise. But that's no longer the case. Really, this change is that we're advocating is really just a modernization, and it's something that's our allies have done very successfully. The United Kingdom, Canada, Australia have all done it, and it's had a positive impact on the rate of sexual assault. They are coming down.
Did those other countries that have similar percentages of men and women serving in the military, did they have sexual assault rates that were comparable to those we see in the U.S. today?
You know, that I don't know, but I know it was an issue, mm-hmm. certainly. And it's still, this isn't going to eliminate everything, but this is why they went out and changed their system, because they were encountering the same kind of problems that we were encountering.
Is this any kind of argument whatsoever for sort of gender segregation of certain military functions?
I don't think so. I don't think so at all. To begin with, more men than women are being sexually assaulted. So,
mm-hmm.
That's the first argument. But secondly, I think, this is our military. I mean, if we can't protect our own soldiers from each other...
Yeah.
I mean, what kind of military do we have? This is something. I strongly believe that the military has to change its prosecutorial system so these decisions are made outside the chain of command. It's all about reporting. There may be these senior officers may be wanting to do the right thing, but people at the bottom of the chain of command who've been assaulted see a system with institutional bias and they don't come forward.
What was your, maybe you'll just share your personal sense of the sincerity of the individuals who are charged with preventing sexual assault in the armed forces. Did you feel as if they truly cared, as if they were truly connected to the problem, or as if they were trying to sweep things under the rug?
Well, for the most part, I feel obviously that they did not want sexual assault in the military. I thought in some cases they were very clueless about what the problems were. In many of them, several of them we spoke to had not even sat down and spoken, one-on-one with a victim. And that is, that allows you to see this perspective in a completely different way. Otherwise, you're seeing it as a bureaucratic problem. Oh, so, such and such percentage of men and women are getting assaulted. What can we do bureaucratically to address this? No. These are men and women's lives. These are our, men and women in uniform in their lives. I mean, this is our responsibility to protect them. And I don't think they really saw it from that perspective. SAPRO, this part of the military that is charged with training, is not overseeing the prosecution side. And up until recently, everything having to do with this issue was thrown to them, and they didn't even have the power to address this. Which, again, said how you know, that the Pentagon was not taking this issue seriously.
And so, again, SAPRO is given responsibility for these prevention campaigns,
right,
but not held clearly not held accountable if they don't work.
Yes, there, it's not, and you know, it's always a situation where, you know, we're you know, that SAPRO is doing the best they can. They're very successful. I mean, they were very proud of you know, wait until she's sober, and you know, as the caller said, everyone that we spoke to considered the SAPRO campaign a joke, but they were going out to the public like, you know, we've got, you know, 90-some percent of men and women have participated in our program. It's a great success. Not at all.
Why did, you know, like Tailhook, not for a while this issue was in front of people and we were talking about it, and then it seems to have gone underground again, and now it's once again emerging. Why haven't we solved this earlier?
Well, I think because the military has done what, you know, I think all powerful institutions do, rather than, in most cases, is rather than confront the problem, they've covered it up. Now, the military has a track record with dealing with a similar issue successfully, and they had a real problem with racism in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and they undertook a decade-long campaign to address it, so that at the end of that decade, racism was less in the military than it was in civilian society. And then these men and women left the military with those values. And now we look at racism in this country, and, you know, it has declined over the last 50 years. Certainly it still exists. But I think the military deserves credit for that, you know, in part for that decline. I think the military could be a leader on this issue as well. It's a perfect time. They're downsizing. They really have to step up. If they don't, 5-10 years from now, I think they're going to find themselves in a real problem with recruiting, where men and women are not going to join the military because they don't believe the military will protect them from sexual assault.
As things stand today, would you recommend that young men and women join the military, given the risk?
I think the military is a great opportunity for many people, and I think it's up to each individual person to make that decision. My job as a journalist, as a filmmaker, is to let people know the truth, let people know the situation, and then have them decide.
Kirby Dick is director of the new documentary, The Invisible War. The film debuts tonight as part of the PBS series Independent Lens. You can see it in North Texas on KERA Channel 13 television. It starts at 10 o'clock. Kirby, thank you so much for spending this time with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. We had Jeff Whittington on the phones today. He is also executive producer of the show, and Christine McConnell produces the podcast. You can learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast cost-free at kera.org/think. We always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. You can send those to us via email to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.